Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR. Now in depth on the Georgopolis theory of grace. That's what writer Sarah Kaufman calls what she learned about how the brain influences physical grace, that effortless ease of movement that can be so dazzling. Remember what a cartoonist once said about Ginger Rogers? She did everything Fred Astaire did, but backwards and on heels. So what is the neuroscience of graceful movement? And how do we emulate the grace of Ginger or Adele, of a skater like Oksana Baiul, or a gymnast like Olga Korbut? As our guests join us this morning, I'm interested in the artists, the athletes, the performers that you think epitomize grace. And tell me why. Here's the phone number, 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. I'm on Twitter at CarrieNPR. As you think about the artists, the athletes, the performers, and others that epitomize grace for you, on Twitter at CarrieNPR. Our guest today, Sarah Kaufman, is a journalist at The Washington Post and the author of The Art of Grace, which is out in paperback. She's with us from Washington, but she's coming here for a lecture on Thursday night at the University of Minnesota. Sarah, welcome. It's good to have you on the show.
It's great to be here. Thanks, Carrie.
Dr. Apostolos Georgopoulos is with us. He's director of the Center for Cognitive Sciences at the University of Minnesota and director of the Brain Scientist Center at the Minneapolis VA. He's in the studio with me. Long time no see. It's really good to have you back in the studio. Welcome.
Good to be here.
Good to have you here. First name's all right with everybody? Is that good?
Absolutely.
Yes. All right. Sarah, I thought you found really descriptive and fresh ways to describe what grace is. And at one point, you say in the book about the directness and the humility of grace. I guess I had not thought that humility would be such a big component of gracefulness. Tell me why it is.
Right. So, you know, one way that I found to think about grace, and there's so many definitions, there's so many perceptions that we all have of this very powerful word, grace. But the element that came through all of the ways of thinking about grace that I came across in my research, whether it's physical or aesthetic grace of a dancer or an athlete, or the social grace of that friend who always has a listening ear and no judgment, the person who makes you just feel so welcome, or spiritual grace, the sense of divine love or a benevolent universe, this encompassing power and peace that help you get through a difficult time. What underlie all of those different forms of grace, I feel, is a sense of ease. Mm. And we feel most comfortable and at ease around people who have a sense of humility because they are then turned outwards. They are turning themselves toward us. You know, they're thinking of other people, not so much about themselves. And it's that turning outward, that attention to others, that nurturing sense of caring for those around us that I feel is really at the center of this beautiful concept of grace.
Do you feel that grace is restrained or joyful?
Joyful. It's all about the joy. Yeah, it's joyful. You know, there is a quietness to grace, though, I think, that can come from a sense of restraint of, if you want to think of it that way, of kind of, you know, sublimating perhaps one's own desires and thinking more about those around us, or in the sense of an athlete or a dancer or someone, you know, an entertainer, perfecting and honing one's skills. Kind of restraining one's attention to this form of discipline, you know, that can be a form of restraint that then delivers joy to the rest of us in watching them.
Apostolos, you say that everyone has the capability to be graceful, and this is what Sarah calls the Georgopolis theory of grace. I've seen people who don't identify, who don't feel like they possess that capacity for grace. What are they missing?
The brain is graceful in the sense that it has been evolved, you know, to control and direct and coordinate movements of every kind, communication, bodily, everything that we do is movement. And it is somehow, if you want, you know, oiled, it is smooth, it is almost by definition graceful. Now, the various degrees, of course, you know, depend on, as Sarah says in the book, you know, how you practice it and how you can perfect it. But all the material is there, you know, the background, the neural substrate is there, and it is made, it has evolved to be smooth and graceful and without rough edges, let's put it that way. So it can be perfected, but it is there, and apparently it exists in all, you know, animals, as far as I know, primates and subprimates, and it's all neurally there.
So when you say our brains possess the capacity, is it then all about practice and repetition?
Well, it is, and as we grow, as we get born and grow, what do we do? We practice walking, we practice reaching and touching and reading, and if you think all of that is movement and all of that is coordinated, and you can see, you can think of the whole practical lifespan being a continuous perfection of what is there to be developed and to be not exactly acquired, but to lead to its realization.
You know what's interesting about this, Sarah, is I think many of us believe that some are just born with an innate sense of physical grace and that it hasn't taken the years of, I mean, you know, when you read about the history of Tiger Woods perfecting his golf game, people want to believe that that was a lot of innate talent that he just had to build a bit on with practice. Instead, what you learn is there was tons of practice and really focused discipline on the and some of the innate gifts that he had. And I think we believe the same about grace, but if I read your book correctly, that's not the case.
Well, exactly. And, you know, this is what I wanted to do in including the scientific perspective in my book. So I have a chapter on the science of grace because that just offers another avenue of understanding this quality. And I had so many questions about grace when I set out to write this kind of comprehensive view of all these different forms of grace and what are the common denominators, what are the examples, what can they teach us about ourselves and about our desire to live in harmony. And, you know, I wanted to know, why do we value grace so highly? Why does it appeal to us? And why are some people, as you say, just so inherently graceful? And that's what was so inspiring about my interviews with Apostolos was the way he broke it down to, first of all, the brain is primarily a motor system, which was a big surprise to me. I think of the brain as, you know, we use it for thinking. But it's this beautifully, almost miraculously coordinated motor system. And with practice, we can all refine our motor movements. Now, what he also said, and I'm sure Apostolos can speak to this a bit more, is that there is still so much mystery in why someone like Tiger Woods or Roger Federer, or the great Russian ballet star Mikhail Baryshnikov, and so many others, seem to just have this beautiful elegance to them, this effortlessness. We can all aspire to refine our movements, and that is part of our natural ability that we can all work on, and that gives us so much joy, you know, to just go out and take a walk and practice a beautiful uplifted posture and an easy stride. So that in itself is graceful. But as for why some people can just sort of pull it together, even though they're spending as many hours in the studio as other people, that I'm not sure we know yet.
I mean, I was going to say, when you use the example of Baryshnikov, he probably think of the many, many, many hours that he perfected his athleticism and his dance. But I mean, the gift is to make it that we don't see all those hours, right? That it does look effortless. What do we know about how the brain, Apostolos, contributes to that sense of effortlessness?
Well, I would say it does it. It doesn't contribute. It is just the reality that, you know, what you see is effortless is the result of a coordinated communication among 100 billion cells. Well, the lesson here is that this has evolved to be like this because in evolution, the survival of the fittest or the most successful ones, that these are the people or the species who really evolve and survive. So I think to turn the argument around, we are graceful and the brain has evolved to have that wonderful capability and potential, it's because evolution pushed that way. So somehow that includes the communication in a social environment and not just the gracefulness of the actions themselves, but, you know, how people really get along together, the ease that Sarah talks about. Apparently those have evolutionary advantage. Otherwise, they wouldn't be here at all. So I think the grace we're talking about is a realization, is an afterthought as to what is given. And of course, genetic capabilities and how the networks work endow us with different ranges of such capabilities. So some people definitely are born to be more easily trainable, to become, the big ones, and the rest of us struggle with you know, the same thing. I could not be a ballet dancer.
I was going to say, so no matter how long you and I practice, we were never going to achieve Baryshnikov.
Exactly. These are extremes.
And yet he still had to put in the time and the repetition and the practice.
Exactly. And that's in everywhere. If I remember correctly, Pablo Casals supposedly practiced years alone the Bach sonatas before he played them in public. And the limits are endowed, we're endowed with. But we all have the capability, and the grace at the base level is something given.
It's good to know. If you've just tuned in, it's a conversation about grace, what we understand about the neuroscience and the physical movement of grace. But Sarah Kaufman is with us, and she's written about grace in a lot of different dimensions and forms. She's with us this morning, the author of The Art of Grace, and Dr. Apostolos Georgopoulos is with us from the University of Minnesota Center for Cognitive Sciences, and we're talking about where the brain fits into this. I'm asking you as you listen in this morning about the artists and the athletes and the performers that you think epitomize grace. And Carlin says on Twitter, Ginger Rogers, she heard the beginning of the conversation, hands down, I wanted to add that she displayed such feminine grace while still being strong and spunky and funny. 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828 for someone who personifies different kinds of grace for you. And on Twitter, at @CarrieNPR, to John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My comment has sort of evolved. I'm curious, taking into consideration the idea beyond, I happen to be a singer and was going to talk about repetition, but beyond that, I was just thinking recently in the last couple of days, a pastor from a local church passed away suddenly, and the outpouring of support for his family and memorials of him talked about his grace as a pastor and how he spoke and how he interpreted the gospel and certainly just his demeanor. And I was thinking, how did that apply to my singing? And I thought, when I suspend after the hours of repetition and after sort of getting over the maybe fear or nerves of being in front of people and performing, the suspension of maybe what we would call the ego and just letting it ride. And I've sort of, you know, maybe being in the zone is something as an athlete or a singer or a dancer or even a pastor, how we are able to sort of take all of those years of preparation and in a singular moment or in a very short moment, sort of get into the zone. And I'd love to know what your guests think about that and what the science might say.
What a great call, John. Thanks. Sarah, what would you say to that?
Yes, I think that that is really central to it. It's that's the transcendence of grace, that you escape the world right around you. As this very astute caller just pointed out, you know, he almost goes beyond himself and what he is doing, and the song rises out of him. And it's that transcendence where a moment is transformed and, you know, the audience is carried along by it that is so powerful about grace. And we can see that in so many ways. That is what very effective pastors have, that ability to tell a story and take us out of our everyday lives and to see a new perspective. That's what athletes have when we appreciate the way Roger Federer does a tap dance across the tennis court. You know, he almost takes us away from just simply watching a game of tennis into seeing something so inspirational, such delightful human achievement that goes beyond what we've seen before. And it's that ability to go beyond, to push beyond our limits and do more than we thought we were capable of. I think that really crystallizes the moment of wonder, which we identify as grace.
You know, I appreciated what you said about a different athlete, and it's Greg Louganis and his diving. You wrote, Greg Louganis's dives not only look good to us, they feel good to us too. We feel into his gracefulness. We're swept into his slipstream. Isn't that funny? You're right that with some athletes, your muscles almost respond kind of involuntarily. Right, because they are drawing you into this dimension of grace that they have.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what I experience, you know, every time I go to the theater and watch a dance performance.
Really?
I mean, swept away, you know, with those dancers that leap across the stage and you leap along with them. You know, it's like the trapeze artist who is swinging above you and you feel that soaring feeling. And this is something that goes back to the brain, that there are studies that suggest that information can flow from one brain to another as we map someone else's physical circumstance into our own sensory motor system. So we are actually feeling something of what another body is doing. We can feel that. We can almost replicate it in our mind and feel that rush, that exhilaration.
Christopher says on Twitter, not just dancers, pratfalls for comedy or ballet roller skating. Charlie Chaplin was one of cinema's most graceful performers. And to the phones to Carol in Rosemont. Hi, Carol.
Good morning.
Hi.
I wanted to bring up the name of the athlete that I think best epitomizes grace, tennis player Roger Federer.
That's actually Sarah
shows,
writes about him. Yeah.
You know, he shows such an ease and an effortlessness on the court. But a lot of the other words that I've heard the panelists mention, the joy and the humility, are all things that I see in his game as well. You know, he excels at tennis, but he never lets his excellence become arrogant or pride. It's just he goes out and he does his job and he does it well, and he makes it look easy, and I love to watch him. And that's to me, what epitomizes grace in an athlete.
Carol, thanks. Well said. To the phones to Denny in Scandia. Hi, Denny. How are you thinking about grace? What's your question?
Well, when you mentioned Pablo Casals, it reminded me of musicians that the more they practice, the more graceful they get. And I'm just wondering, is there such a thing, pardon me, as muscle memory, or are all of these things just subroutines that get built up in the brain? The brain is like an iceberg.
The brain is like an iceberg. What do you mean?
Well, 90% of what we see, 10% of what we see in the brain is things we can access. The rest is all below the surface. We're not permitted to get into the subconscious mind, but it sends us signals when we need to know something. And I'm just curious as whether there really is a thing called muscle memory, or is it a subroutine in the brain that, for example, I play the guitar and I can move my fingers much faster than I can think about what the next note is going to be.
Let's ask our brain scientist about
that. Sure. Well, the answer is in between. You know, definitely, as you probably know, the muscles themselves are under continuous control, back and forth, this feedback control as well as forward control from the spinal cord. And the spinal cord gets all the messages from the brain and communicates continuously with the brain. So the right way to think about it is the brain-muscle system. You know, there's no such thing as an isolated muscle. So memory in the muscle fiber itself, as far as we know, there's no memory in it. But the muscle at no time is in that condition. It is always responding to neural signals and sending back neural signals. And we know that the signals in the spinal cord, where the immediate control of the muscle is, are also can be modified, changed depending on ongoing signals from the brain. So yes, you're right that the more you practice, the more all of this system, think of it as a muscle, a spinal cord, a central brain, is evolving to a state that is graceful in the general sense. That is, it is smooth, it is not rough, it is not edgy, and what we see is a nice, smooth, performance. And I go back to your previous, the very earlier sort of question with the ego, where the ego interferes. Let the brain do its work, and everything will be much more graceful. That's why you close your eyes, you say, you give a speech, forget about the audience and everything, that's very common. We're interfering. Our thinking interferes with our gracefulness. And I'm not sure you can intentionally be graceful. I mean, the whole thing is to do it and practice it and let it be, let it show up.
One other question about muscle memory, because I was thinking about this last night at my exercise class. The instructor played a very old bit of music. I hadn't heard it in more than a year, easily more than a year. And yet I remembered exactly what to do, exercise-wise, choreography-wise. Why?
Well, because that's how we are. The brain works in a cumulative fashion. Nothing is left behind. So you keep, yes, you can call it memory, but it is more of a network shaping, memory, not the exact event, memory. And you definitely keep that for years. You can remember something like that from your childhood. And all of a sudden, you do that jump that you used to do when you're 5 years old.
Right. Even if someone had said, what are the steps when you hear, without the music and without being in that place, if someone had asked me what are the steps that go with this music, I probably couldn't have described
them. Exactly. You're not supposed to.
What do you mean when you say you're not supposed to?
Well, you're not supposed to know what are the steps that lead, to the performance. It's just performance is by itself. You do not have always insights as to how that is done in the brain. You don't have access to such circuits.
Sarah, what do you think about this idea of not overthinking the movement, the performance? I think that's really good advice. It's hard to do,
Indeed. Yes, not overthinking it. So, again, I think it's the point of turning yourself outwards towards others. As Apostolos said, you almost forget about your speech, and you can think about an intention. I want to bring joy to the audience, or I want to persuade the audience of my point of view. And you kind of give yourself over to that rather than being nervous about the individual mechanics of it. So I think that that's part of it. And the thinking is interesting. There can be, however, a type of grace that comes when we are forced to pay minute, close attention to things. And when you brought up overthinking, I was reflecting on a woman who I met, who I write about in the book, who had muscular sclerosis. So she had been an athlete, a go-getter, a policy analyst in Washington, really jet-setting world traveler, and then suddenly was diagnosed with MS, which made it difficult for her to even walk out her front door sometimes. And she was used to such a rushed, hectic pace of life that had become her lifestyle. Suddenly, she was forced to slow down, and she really had to pay attention to every move, or she would fall. She would, you know, literally lose her balance. And what she told me she found through the struggle with this condition, which has, you know, some very uncomfortable and you know, bad side effects, she found a new type of balance. She found a peacefulness that came from slowing down that she had never had access before in her life. And she said, this is when I truly found grace, when I had to pay attention. And the attention became a joy. So paying attention to birds coming to her bird feeder outside her window, when sometimes that was the only contact with the outside world she had. Meditating, getting massages, those small things that she had never had time for that brought her a sense of ease and kind of came from having to pay attention. And as her world grew smaller, in fact, her world paradoxically grew bigger because she saw there were so many possibilities.
Sarah Kaufman's with us, if you've tuned in. She's the author of The Art of Grace and a Washington Post dance critic, and Apostolos Georgopoulos with us from the University of Minnesota, where he's a neuroscientist. They will give a public lecture together on Thursday night, 4 o'clock. Details on our page. It is public and open at the University of Minnesota. We'll get a look at the latest news. We'll continue our conversation. More of your calls and questions as you think about who personifies grace. And it doesn't just have to be physical grace. And maybe it's a kind of intellectual grace. Talk to me about that. Think about that. And 651-227-6000, 800-242-2828. But to Phil Picardi now. Hi, Phil.
Hi, Carrie. President-elect Donald Trump's spokesman says Trump has named Elaine Chao his transportation secretary. Chao is a former labor secretary and deputy transportation secretary in the two Bush administrations. Trump met with retired General David Petraeus yesterday. He was scheduled to meet with Mitt Romney again today. The U.S. economy has been chugging along at its strongest pace in 2 years. The government says the gross domestic product expanded at an annual rate of 3.2% in the third quarter. A revised report shows stronger consumer spending than first estimated. There's also word today U.S. consumer confidence is at its highest level in more than 9 years. Ohio State University says it will hold a vigil on campus tonight as a way to begin healing after a car and knife attack on campus injured 11 people yesterday. Classes there have resumed after the attack yesterday morning, investigators say, was carried out by Abdul Artan, an OSU student born in Somalia. Police say he had complained on Facebook about what he saw as U.S. interference in countries with Muslim communities. Tennessee officials say thousands of residents and visitors in the Gatlinburg area have been evacuated, and hundreds of structures have been damaged and or destroyed by spreading wildfires. Authorities say three people who suffered severe burns have been transferred from a Knoxville hospital to Vanderbilt Medical Center in Nashville, which has a burn unit. Hundreds of firefighters, as well as local and state personnel and National Guard troops, have been sent in to help fight the blaze and check on people in Tennessee. More news ahead on NPR News. The time now is 10:43.
The chairman of the Tribal Council of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe speaks publicly for the first time about the ongoing Dakota Access Pipeline protest taking place near his reservation. I'm Kathy Worzer. We'll have that story for you and all the news tomorrow on Morning Edition.
I'm Tom Weber. Next hour on NPR News, you'll learn the latest on the race for DNC chair, which includes Minnesota Congressman Keith Ellison in the running. You'll also hear about reporters at the St. Paul Pioneer Press trying to find someone to buy the paper from its current owner. All of that at 11.
Programming supported by the Vocal Lessons Chorus and Ensemble Singers presenting Welcome Christmas, featuring Conrad Sousa's Carols and Lullabies, weaving together the music of Mexico and the American Southwest, accompanied by harp, marimba, and guitar. VocalLessons.org.
I hate to turn up out of the blue uninvited, but I couldn't stay away. I couldn't fight it. I had hoped you'd see my face and that you'd be reminded that for me it isn't over.
That's Adele in the midst of our conversation this morning about the art of grace. It's someone that Sarah Kaufman actually writes about in her book. What is it? Maybe we can let it play a little bit under the discussion. Sarah, what is it about Adele that that motivated you to write about her grace?
Adele is just a fantastic example of grace. I recently took my 14-year-old daughter to her concert here in Washington a couple weeks ago. It was a big highlight of my life.
I'll bet.
You know, she has, not only does she write songs that delve so deeply into vulnerability, but she also has this great sense of humor as a performer, where she made this whole stadium full, this whole arena full of people feel like, you know, we were all her besties. And just this one little anecdote about her that I thought really epitomized her grace. She, you know, was so mindful that everybody wanted to take photos of her with their phones and so forth. And she said, okay, I'm going to, in her British accent, which I won't replicate for you, but she said, I'm going to just sort of walk around the stage and I'll squat down and you can hold your phone up and turn around and take a selfie with me. And so she gets herself into this ungainly position in her beautiful long gown, you know, but she wasn't above, you know, kind of poking fun at herself and reaching out to her public to give them what, you know, a really lovely, lasting impression. I took pictures of that happening, and it was just so funny. It was funny, and it was warm, and it was
graceful.
Humble. Exactly.
And graceful, right?
Yeah.
And mistakes their memories made, who would have known how bittersweet this would taste.
Let's go to the phones to Randy in Minneapolis. Hey, Randy. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah,
great,
sure.
Great discussion.
What do you want to add to this?
Well, I'm just curious. We've talked a lot about, you know, athletes and movement and this idea of physical grace. And I'm kind of curious about this idea of energetic grace. I'm
okay.
A restorative yoga teacher.
Mm-hmm.
And just this idea of people being able to kind of drop ego and come to this place of letting go so that there's this inner movement that I think, you know, there's an element of grace to that.
So when you say letting your muscles go, what do you really mean?
Well, in restorative yoga, the idea is that you're passively just in postures without physically activating the body. So there's not really movement. You're holding yourself in this place that allows a grounding and this way to energetically allow movement in the body. So there's no physical movement. It's an inner movement that brings rest and restoring an inner peace to a person. But to me, when I see my students in that moment, I just see this transformation. And to me, it does feel like grace.
So glad you called apostolist.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, of course. It doesn't have to be an outward motion. Well, think of it. I mean, I think the energetic aspect, as you mentioned, the most obvious sort of example for me would be like the energy that you store when you lift a weight. You know, so you have the dynamic energy, if you want, when you move and throw a stone and everything. But you store energy, you know, where you say lift a weight and then you let it drop, and that's where the energy is. So I think your example is just wonderful, is setting up the stage for what follows, as you said, discover and let the brain be in a state that can implement any kind of graceful activity after that. But the preparation itself is graceful as far as the brain is concerned.
Do you meditate or do yoga?
I don't do yoga. I meditate occasionally. But if I can add something to what Sarah mentioned before about the woman with the multiple sclerosis,
yes.
It's a wonderful example of the capability of the brain to adapt. It's exactly, you know, what you take for granted when you don't have, you know, a brain sort of condition, a neurological disease. But when you have one, then you can restore to a good extent what you would normally call, you know, a graceful activity, mm-hmm. by discovering and practicing and paying attention. The ultimate result of that is, again, to come back to a different level of grace. But the brain has that fantastic capability that you can restore that, even if not everything is working properly.
Call here from Stuart in Minneapolis. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
And I am a photographer, and I've done this for many, many years. I go out into the world and look around and see what's there. And one of the, I guess, bedrock adages that applies to the world of photography that I operate in is knowing just where to stand.
Ah.
Standing in the right place. And for me, what we're getting at is essentially an ineffable experience, but, you know, words do try to get us into the neighborhood. So for me, it is a feeling that all is right around me, that I am placed very well. I could say I've also danced for decades, too, and it's something, a similar placement of my body in motion that gives me that sense of balance. But getting back to the photography, it's just... like I said, knowing where to stand and that feeling that all is right around you.
And Stuart, it sounds like you've done this for some time. You know that moment when it happens, right?
I wouldn't say a higher cerebral type of knowing.
Right.
Yeah, it's more of a haptic feeling that you're just there and it's right, and that's when you do what you feel you need to do.
I imagine you're tuned in to your surroundings in that moment in a way that you probably aren't just day to day.
Yes. Yeah, I do send myself off on missions to places that I imbue with a certain powerful symbolic element, I guess, or metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
I've spent a lot of time in polar regions, which is where I would say my soul feels most right. And I've stood at the North and South Poles, and let me tell you, if you want to feel right about everything being just around you, that's a place to go to.
I'm really glad you called.
Okay,
thanks.
Thank you.
Sarah, what do you hear in that?
I think that's fantastic. It's like this, there's this, grace is such a great organizing principle. It sort of calls us to do so many things that just promote ease and rightness, as the callers have brought up, the photographer and the restorative yoga teacher, you know, just these activities that just where we just feel right in the world. Sometimes there is very little motion involved in that. And these categories of physical grace, social grace, and spiritual grace are very elastic. So a moment that can be highly physical can also strike us as very spiritual, or a moment, you know, someone being warm and kind to us can feel spiritual, or a moment of nothing at all, just being right in the world, obviously also has a spiritual quality to it. And it's you know, there's this great worldview of grace that we all can access, that help us to find these moments of ease and calm and tranquility. And making adjustments as necessary is, you know, what the caller just talked about, making adjustments as necessary to find those, being flexible.
August says, in Ely, I keep thinking about the Italian term sprezzatura, Artura, which means effortless mastery. Apostolos, thank you very much. Good to have you in the studio. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Sarah,
thank you,
good luck. Good luck with the lecture at the University of Minnesota, and thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Carrie.
We're going to close with a little bit of music that you mentioned in The Art of Grace. Here's the Beach Boys.
I love the colorful clothes you wear and the way the sunlight plays upon her hair. I hear the sound of a gentle wind on the wind that lifts her perfume through the air.
Book is called The Art of Grace. You can read about it on the thread.